title. But as it happens, Dr. Farrell has close to 30 years experience doing mission work in our denomination. For, get this right, 21 years, he was in the field as a mission worker, first in Zaire, presently the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then in Peru, where he drew international attention to the situation affecting 8,000 children who were being poisoned by a U.S.-owned metal smelter in their community. From 2007 until last year, Dr. Hunter was the director of World Mission for the PCUSA, and for nearly a year now, since last October, has served as the director of the World Mission Initiative at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, which is why he happens to be in Pittsburgh. We are very fortunate. So I'm pleased to present to you this evening Dr. Farrell.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. I thought you were going to say he's had 30 years of experience doing good. They put this over here. Will that work? Will everybody be able to see?
Thank you. Yeah,
see that. The images as well. Good. Well, thanks for the intro. I'm really glad to be here, and I really enjoy the opportunity to think with, particularly with congregations, with groups of folks who are united by some kind of a common faith, when we talk about this topic. And I think it's fair to say I have spent 30 years trying to do good. And so if you get qualified to give a talk like this because you've made every mistake in the book, then I'm really qualified. So that may be my big qualification. I want us to think a little bit about the changes in charitable giving and in mission giving and in the way that we make decisions about the mission of the church, however you would define that, right? And so from, you know, I'm 59 years old, so when I was growing up, the way that the church made its decisions about mission giving were kind of enshrined in the Edinburgh Missionary Conference, where a group of white, elite, male, North Americans and Europeans got together. They were experts in their field. They spoke probably 40 languages together. They had studied world religions. They were the best equipped and qualified people in the world to make decisions on the mission of the church. So they got together in a collaborative style, and they allocated mission resources. They cooperated. They did the comity agreements. They said, in Guatemala, you Presbyterians go to the Central Highlands. You UCC folks go to the north. You disciples go to the west. And they divided it up so we wouldn't duplicate unnecessarily. No one asked the Guatemalans, of course, so there are some downsides to this way of engaging mission decisions. But I want to set this up as it was kind of people who were very qualified to do it, but they were limited in their reach. If you fast forward it to today, who makes mission decisions for the Presbyterian Church today?
But why were they qualified to do it? They were white elite people and didn't care at all what the people even, I mean, you know, they're going in and deciding, I'm better than you.
It was based on the hierarchies.
Right, so I don't think they were qualified at all.
Through Western education. I would set up for you that they had a lot more knowledge of the situation than, say, folks in the pew.
Okay.
I set up like that. Now, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, said Abraham Lincoln. And so we'll go in that direction. I'm trying to get the pendulum over here before I allow it to swing over your way. Okay? So the interesting thing to me in this is it allows us to see that today, by the work of the Holy Spirit, I believe, the playing field has been leveled. We have people all over the country and all over the world making mission decisions. There are more Nigerians who travel in international mission than there are people from Great Britain today. All kinds of people are engaging in mission decision-making in ways that would surprise our parents' and grandparents' generations. So it's been we could say the world is flat in many ways. There's been a leveling of that, those hierarchies based on white, elite, Western education, et cetera, some of those things that I was suggesting. One of the challenges with that, though, is you give mission decision-making to people whose only qualification is they have a dollar in their pocket. Mm-hmm. Then the people who have more dollars are exercising more bang for the buck, so to speak. The folks who have fewer dollars, less impact and less reach, if you will. And so that's going to skew us towards certain kinds of mission activities. I did a study of Presbyterian mission decision makers, the people in congregations. It was 700 congregations across the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church USA. 700 congregations. Who are the people of your congregation who make mission decisions? From them, I got their results back. And of those folks who are making mission decisions, I asked how many of you are allocating funds to justice ministries? Either for you yourself, you're supporting personally a justice ministry, or your church. Only 17% of folks across the Presbyterian Church USA, the people who are doing mission around the world. Well, that really surprised me, because I thought, well, heck, these are folks who are going to be heavily engaged in justice issues, but they're not. So I asked, what are you engaged in? Well, the top three, number one, is child sponsorship. A full 62% of these mission decision makers personally sponsor a child through one of the top six child sponsorship agencies, World Vision, Compassion International, etc. There's a bunch of them. Now, not all of them, but among the worst infractions, one of those groups, and I won't name because it was a confidential interview when I interviewed these folks about seven years ago, at that time they were taking 88% on the dollar. So 88 cents on the dollar stayed in the U.S. to fund the operation here, more fundraising, the staff that they employed here, and only 12 cents on the dollar was going overseas. And from there, that 12 cents, some of that went to national costs, and only maybe 6 cents on the dollar was reaching the child or children, maybe children of a village. A lot of them, including World Vision, finally had moved to a more community-based structure where they're actually supporting a whole community instead of paying one child, etc. Because those were causing craziness in lots of families where two children would be sponsored, the rest wouldn't. Your kids are sponsored, mine aren't, and what does that do to our relationship in a face-to-face society, etc. So a lot of issues raised with those sponsorship programs to this day, but Americans and U.S. Presbyterians are supporting those kinds of programs hand over fist. It's the most popular kind of mission engagement for our churches. Well, that surprised me. A second area that was supported by lots of mission decision makers was packaged meals. I don't know if you've seen the programs. They're really big now in colleges, at summer camps. Anytime you get young people together, they'll have a day where they'll take a four-hour period, and they'll package rice, beans, all kinds of freeze-dried vegetables, etc., and then send those to different places in the world. The challenge is, what it does is when you send free food to a community, it depresses agricultural prices, and farmers say, well, I can't compete with this. Why should I plant? Because I'm not going to make enough money to feed my family. And so, in fact, in non-disaster situations, disaster situations can be very helpful. You're feeding other people. In non-disaster situations, it can be very harmful. But, again, Presbyterian mission leaders are supporting those kinds of projects with a lot of gusto. The final area was in orphanages, which had been proven in this country that's not the best way to support children who need support. But rather, if you can work through an extended family or through other concerned individuals closer to that individual, closer to the child, you'll do a lot better job. So, with all that landscape of mission giving, it's really swung in a way that makes the donor feel very good about their work. Mm. How many of us don't have a kid's picture pasted on our refrigerator? because it feels good to do that. I look at Facebook posts every day of my friends who are traveling on a short-term mission trip. That's the fourth most popular way to engage in mission, is to travel in mission, either domestically or internationally. And a good number of Presbyterians, it's a $5 billion a year industry. Last year, $5 billion was spent by U.S. Christians on mission trips, either locally, nationally, or internationally. So we're putting a lot of money into these kinds of mission projects, and Connie Newton and Fran Early would ask the question, who are we really helping? You say you're doing good. Says who? Have you talked to the people impacted? Could we open up the conversation? Could we tone down the rhetoric and open up a conversation where we could ask some basic questions of people who we say we're helping? It may be that their version doesn't match ours. And wouldn't that be a great conversation to have? What can we do to facilitate that, to open up that conversation? So that's the preliminary things that I wanted to toss out of the table. I'm really glad that you all were gracious enough to invite me. I'll be honest, this is the topic of... I've had to defend questions of human sexuality before very angry Presbyterian groups of people. I've had to talk about Israel-Palestine before very angry groups of people. I mean, there have been a lot of angry conversations in my last 10 years of life. But this is the one where it has generated the strongest impact. And with all due respect to all of us, including myself, I wonder, are we dealing with a sacred cow here? That once you begin to raise a question about the way we're engaging in benevolence or charity, it touches something deep in us. Because I may just be stumbling into a sensitive area because I realized I really stirred up a lot as I've had conversations with folks. You have a question?
Yeah, so I walked in late. I'm really sorry. No problem. I'm sure you covered this, but for my own sake, So all of these volunteers and nonprofits and donors, are you speaking strictly from like a religious mission-focused view, or are you talking about all other nonprofits that do sort of international aid?
Great question. Newton and Early are not Christian in orientation. This is a much broader book, and it's why I recommended it. There's some other books, Toxic Charity, that's really more focused on Christian groups. When Helping Hurts, very focused on church-based groups. But I thought the broader conversation might be more interesting here at 6th, just to think in terms of, because a number of you all are maybe plugged into maybe a nurses association or a teachers association, professional associations that are also attempting to do good. So I wanted to keep this as broad as possible. There'll be particular implications of faith that we can talk about, but I'm going to keep it broad early in the conversation. So thanks for scoping that for us. Yes, please.
Could you tell me how you said not many Christians are, Presbyterians are contributing to justice causes or justice missions. How would you define a justice?
Yeah, it's a mission project that looks at the root causes of poverty or injustice and seeks through the allocation of funding or human resources, time, advocacy, to make a change in that root cause. So different from more of a charity model, it's looking to take care of, to address the symptoms of the problem. Someone's hungry, so I'm going to give them something to eat. Teaching them, giving them the fish to give them something to eat, teaching them the fish would be more of a development project. So we've got charity, we've got development, and then justice to me would be asking the deeper questions. Paulo Freire, his approach, looking deeper, asking the why questions, a series of why questions. Why is it that this person is hungry? Because they don't have a job. Why is it that they don't have a job, etc.? And so you're actually addressing some of those root causes. It's slower work. It's hard work. And it takes relationship and time on the ground. And so when our pendulum has swung to a short-term orientation, that's going to present some challenges for us. Okay? That's how it goes to work. Okay, so why don't we go forward? Thank you. I appreciate that. Pushing us to the next.
There we go.
Now this, here's my subtitle, and you can't let it out of this room. But this is what I discovered. I would go to progressive churches. I'm progressive. I'd go to a progressive church,
And they would throw more darts at global mission. Because what do we connote? What does global mission connote to us? But colonialism,
yes.
paternalism, you know, the manifest destiny. Go ahead.
Evangelism,
manifest destiny, my way or the highway, my imposition of faith. Indian schools, right? Native American children being ripped out of their own home community. Many people told, put on a tie, that's how you worship God. I mean, all those very painful instances. I can go on all night, I better stop, right? I mean, there's a lot of instances. I did this work for 30 years. There's a lot of painful contradiction when we went with our whole culture. And it was a lot of process of imposition. There was also, by God's grace, there was also a lot of spaces of powerful transformation, both in local cultures and in the culture of the missionaries. Some of the most courageous champions for justice today in the United States had a missionary experience. Their lives were changed by the people who they went to save. They got turned around, and then they came back and said, I need to address some of the root causes of poverty in Peru by coming back to the United States. So there's a whole group of folks whose lives are transformed in those cross-cultural spaces and come back to champion issues of justice. But there is a kind of a divide, and so when I first talked to Vince, I knew Vince from before in the denomination, but he called me. I hadn't been in Pittsburgh for a month, and one of the first pastors who called was Vince. And he said, we need to talk about global mission. I said, oh, good. Please. And so we sat there. We had our conversation was as spicy as the Thai food we were eating. It was a great time. Because he holds on to some of those concerns, how global mission has been both packaged and used, not only in our denomination, but in lots of places around the world. So I appreciated the honesty. And he said, you know, I think you may need to come and talk with a barter group because we have some concerns about global mission. So anyway, that I think may have been the genesis. I don't know how Tom, you would be better to. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Pardon my tongue-in-cheek humor here. I'm playing with y'all. Let me ask if you would be willing to share with someone that you're sitting with one lesson that you learned from the book. How many people had a chance to read the book?
Started.
Okay. Maybe we'll do this. So fewer people have. Why don't we do this together? You all. Okay, yeah. And it's some similar ideas. Toxic charity, when helping hurts, from different theological viewpoints. But they're asking some similar questions. They're different books. But they're asking some similar questions. What I appreciate about Newton and Early is they're looking with very broad-minded questions of when two cultures engage. Mostly from the North American and mostly dominant North America. We're talking primarily about whites, moneyed whites who were venturing out into other countries using money and their time, sometimes their and not often their power, to engage change in those societies. So that's a bit the gist of theirs, whereas Toxic Charity is very faith-based and when helping hurts even more so. Was there an idea that came to you from that book, a lesson or something that said, you know what, I'd like to think about this, I'd like to apply this for the way that our church engages in work around the world. Did anything come to anyone if you had a chance to read or start that book?
Well, certainly one of the things is going with an attitude of that you have much to learn from others rather than a lot to tell. Mm-hmm. That seems like a life lesson that should have been learned in kindergarten.
Right. In a committed relationship with kids, with friends, with the world, right? Yeah. No, what a beautiful
thing. Well, I think that's the kind of lesson we learn our whole lives. Mm. And the process of opening ourselves up is a lifelong process.
Mm. Mm. Amen.
That's what you're talking about, Carol. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my experience. Mm. I didn't read the book, though.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're halfway through then. Good. Well, I wanted to get a sense of that. Okay, let's go to the next slide. I'd like us to think a little bit, if we could. I wanted to look, a lot of times we talk about cultural difference, but we don't clarify what is it that we're talking about. We talk about cultural proficiency or cultural humility or different ways of describing people who are adept in cross-cultural interaction. Well, I wanted to tease out, if I could, and this is from some cultural anthropology, just to think about some differences. And if it's helpful, the book is located or situated in Guatemala, and so I'll think with you about some of the things that we understand about and the way that indigenous Guatemalans describe their own reality, and I'll posit that against ways that we would describe in dominant U.S. culture some of the ways that we would describe ourselves. So among in the community that I grew up in Dallas, Texas, a fairly moneyed, we were talking, you know, the top of the church of the 1% or whatever in the global context, we're highly individualistic. We think in terms of I. In most Guatemalan languages, it's considered audacious or a little brash for young people to speak too often in the first person singular. What do you know that has not been given to you to know? Your family, your ancestors, and your community would be what mothers would ask. And so it's just a different way of understanding. So collectivism, a sense of we as a body, we as a community together, you're not going to make an agreement, you're not going to make a decision by yourself. When someone comes in and says, hey, would you like to go to the United States and go to college? You're going to wait, you're going to check with the elders, you're going to talk with your family. There's other, whereas in our context, well, that's kind of an individual decision. You decide who you marry by yourself. You don't need your parents' permission necessarily. If you were, and fewer of us are getting on our knee and asking our spouse to marry us and going to the parents of the spouse to ask for permission. We're doing that less and less. We're more and more isolated, cut off from our families, and more. I'll just go through this quickly. Low and high power distance. We have a notion of ourselves in this culture to be very, as if we inhabited a flat earth. It's a democratic society. Everyone has the same power, right? That's our myth about ourselves. That's not really true. And particularly to have folks who have been on the underside of dominant culture power to speak would be important in this conversation. But I do want to contrast that to a context like Guatemalan indigenous folks who would have a very pronounced hierarchy of hierarchical understanding of social relationships. And so they may not speak to certain people in their community context because they don't have the right to do so. There's a deep respect for that person because of age, gender, because of their office in the town or city. We're folks who have low risk avoidance. We can risk a lot. We honor certain people, entrepreneurs, people who are trying money. If you win, if you bet big, that's great. We think more highly of you. For that, we honor that in our culture. Whereas in Guatemala, folks are going to be less willing in many contexts, and I'm generalizing tremendously, but they're going to be much less reticent to put all their eggs in a basket until they're certain that that's going to care for those eggs. We're willing to risk because oftentimes out of our plenty, materialism, our sense of plenty, we're willing to make investments. We have a very short-term engagement, a short-term scope. We see the world in short-term increments, whereas in Guatemala, you'll find a lot of indigenous folks speaking from a long-term perspective. But what might this do in the long run to us and our relationships? We tend to be very explicit in our speaking. If you're from the northern part of the U.S., you may be even more explicit than folks from the south. My wife's a northerner, I'm a southerner, and she says, you're always walking around the bush a couple of times. Just say what you mean. That's within the U.S. context. I think you find it even more pronounced. There was a missionary from the PCUSA who was in Zaire. He just died recently. I put up on Facebook that this man had died, and I put his the eulogy, that several paragraphs from his eulogy. I posted that. Well, I watched. He was a man who had, I would say, troubled relationships with a lot of number of Congolese, the people that he worked with. He was a tough cookie, just a tough man to get along with. And the Congolese were very sensitive to issues of power and racism in this interaction that they had with him.
And one of the Kamalini's friends, this is a guy I've known for 30 years, he put the most beautifully worded statement that if you read it, on the face of it, you can't tell what he's saying. He says, I'm reminded of the child who gets on a bike and goes downhill and no one can stop them. And so most Americans read that and say, well, huh, that's poetic, but what does that have to do with this mission? In Kamali's more implicit way of speaking, he's saying, nobody could stop this guy. He just did what he was going to do. And we couldn't, there was nothing we could do. We were the adults in the room, he was the child, and he went for it. And it was fascinating to me to see, because I've watched some Americans that respond to that post, and they're like, what's this about? And I realized what a difference we have. We'll just grab it by the jugular and say, this is what it is. And in many places around the world, there's a lot more care and respect and a caution, and to speak indirectly or implicitly. And finally, that sense of identity versus function. You and I talk about the difference between being and doing, right? And how many mission trip groups go to a place and they're not satisfied until they do something, when it may be that the host community wants to be with them, just be in relationship. And so there's that tension in our spirits. We get a lot of times we get some impatience because we want to, this is going to be worth our time, right? So we say we got to go do something. Well, that's a little bit, I'm trying to tease out some of the differences, and I spoke in massively generalized terms. I'd be kicked out of the American Anthropological Association if you heard me talk this way. But I'm just trying to tease out some of the difference to help us think of some of the bumps we're going to hit in this road towards doing good together. Okay, let's go to the next one. Great. Okay, let's go ahead. We'll be ahead with this. That's right. And I illustrated these in different ways with different pictures from short-term mission groups that have been sent to me over the years. Okay. Yeah, and you can scroll through all those things. Great. Okay, let's go to the next one then. Well, I would say that we've got a problem here. We've got these different cultural tendencies. We're individualistic people. We think of ourselves as operating from a low power distance. We're unaware of our powers, what that means. Mm-hmm. Low risk, we're willing to try new things on anybody, pretty much. On ourselves, but also on others. We have a short-term focus. We're not thinking of the implications for tomorrow. We're going to call it like we see them. We call it like we see them, and that can be very hurtful for folks if they're not prepared for that. We value doing over actually being with people. Well, that, and we North Americans of dominant culture tend to test very high for ethnocentricity. We, more than most peoples in the world, there's a couple of nationalities that when they do national testing, that rank higher than us. But we really believe that our way is the best way. And there's a sense, almost, of what you call evolutionary anthropology, that we think that everybody, given enough time, they'll grow up and be just like us. You know, give them time, these third world countries, someday, you know, let's give them foreign aid and education and all that. Maybe someday, if they're lucky and they work hard, they'll be just like us. Well, that's ethnocentricity, and we rank pretty high in ethnocentricity. Racism has been a part of the structure of both mission and foreign aid since the beginning. And so we just need to name that as a reality. We're making assessments that we're assuming about people of other ethnicities and races based on the color of their skin. And that's a given. And as you read the mission history, you become painfully aware of this. Hand in hand with this is what I would describe as white privilege. I think you all are well aware of as a sociological concept. But you get this as a base, and this swirl of values and cultural preferences, and if you move to the next one, Tom, I think what we have is the perfect storm. Right? This is when you think about it, I mean, this is what we're unleashing on communities all over the world as we make decisions. Maybe it's only $200. You're going to decide, how do we spend $200 of mission money? You're going to allocate funds. Well, we've got a lot swirling around in the room in this kind of perfect storm. I chose, there happens to be four, or I don't know, I haven't seen this movie, but I think it's four white men. And so, with males...
No, there's a
African American.
Okay, he's African American.
Third from the right.
Okay, thank you. So if you have a majority, let's go with that. Majority of white males in the room, we test higher in all of those things. We're more individualistic. We're more risk prone. Or if you go all the way around that circle, we white males, we top the charts. And there's not another nationality, when they test nationalities, that ranks higher in individualism. And we white males among North Americans test the highest in the sociological breakdown. So I'm just trying to set up in a humorous way, and bear with me, I'm not trying to offend anyone, but we just have to realize that we're going in with an awful lot of baggage into this cross-cultural encounter. Okay? Great, that's one of the things that I can. So we want to look together at Newton and Early's five principles. In this book, Doing Good Says Who? Stories from volunteers, nonprofits, donors, and those they want to help. What I appreciate about them, they're saying they're meeting people where they are. They want to do good. That's a great thing. And Early and Best don't criticize them for that. They recognize that's a good thing. They never say a critical word about that. The question they're asking is a deeper one. Is how can we channel that desire to do good in ways that actually help people around the world and open the space for transformation? Because in each of the five principles, you'll notice there's a twist by the end of the chapter as something turns in the room and the person who went to help is actually helped to see themselves and see themselves with new eyes. Maybe in some transformational way. So I think it's powerful. I think it also is very reflective of the reality that lots of folks who work cross-culturally, not just in Guatemala, but here in Pittsburgh, people who reach across cultural lines seeking to help better the situation of people in this city, and they find that they went to serve and they're being served. They went to help and they're being helped. Their own brokenness is being healed by the experience of working with people across cultural lines. So I want us to be particularly attentive to that. Let's look, if we could. Let me stop for a second and let's take a breath. I've dumped a lot on you. You're still smiling, most of you. Some of you are a little angry, but that's okay. But I want to get a sense, does this resonate? Do you recognize some of these cultural preferences that I've described? Is there one of those that you say, boy, that's really true? I mean, you see that people that you know, and yourself, and in others?
Power.
Yeah. And say, how is that in the use of power? How do we
move? I think we've been talking about this now for about 2 or 3 years, about white privilege and the subconscious, the unawareness that we have of all of the ways in which our privilege impacts our interactions with others. And the consciousness raising that we have avoided undertaking.
The painfulness that we've sensed, maybe reticence, because that is a painful.
I'm just struck by how our entire national sort of enterprise is all on the wrong side of, I mean, our military, our economic structure throughout the world, I mean, everything falls on the wrong side of this. Mm-hmm. It's not just charity, it's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you. And that you're then pointing us to the deeper questions that we can talk about this, and you know, our charity is a drop in the bucket when you talk about impacting the world. We go deeper, the military-industrial complex that my little charitable-industrial complex is at play on is a much deeper issue than that. Thanks.
Well, it's hard for me to comment because you've lived so many years in Guatemala, Peru, and Congo. The only country I know that I've ever lived in except the United States is Germany, and for 2 weeks, Nicaragua. And there are two other people who know Germany very, very well. But one of the things that was hard for me to get used to was that Germans have a very confrontational style. And when I was living there and teaching in a German college, people would always say these things which sound very aggressive. Why are your presidents all so stupid? Why can't you have better presidential candidates? We had Jimmy Carter versus Ronald Reagan. How can you have such stupid candidates?
What did you say?
Well, as an American, you know, Americans are kind of caught flat-footed by that. We're not used to that confrontation. So, to me, as an American, that came across as rude. I grew up in Virginia, and I wouldn't say that to somebody. But then I began to realize that's the way they get in touch. So one of my students ran for city council in the city in Costco, and he had a call-in show, and I called in, and he said, well, Cliff, you don't think we're anti-American, do you? He was a member of the SPD, which was the most aggressive socialist party trying to prevent the stationing of the middle stretch of Cajun, the Rockets. But he didn't want to be perceived as being anti-American. So what interested me in what you said was that Americans, we tend to be very upfront and explicit. But compared to some other European nations, we're kind of shy. Mm-hmm.
And so we're on a continuum, and we would posit, for example, in individualism, we and white South Africans outrank everybody else. Okay? In terms of the explicit communication, we're strong. Germany, Sweden, yeah. Denmark surpass us on that. Japan, China, some of the East Asian nations, indigenous folks of many different cultural contexts. So again, these are national surveys, much more indirect, much more implicit in their communication styles. So again, we're referencing national surveys that are trying to get a sense of patterns of communication without saying that every individual, you know, if you're a Swede, this is how you talk. Right, we're not trying to say that, so I don't want to be so deterministic. But just to give us a sense of, these are some of the problems that we're setting up for ourselves as we encounter folks who are culturally different from us in these spaces, whether they be spaces of mission, or the military, or government, or foreign aid, all these different spaces of cultural interaction. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was just thinking, years ago I was on the librarian on the semester at sea, a voyage that went around the world, and we visited lots of different countries, and I repeatedly noticed the reaction to my questions, because my questions, especially in Asia, were perceived as blunt and offensively blunt sometimes, and I had to sort of, maybe by the end of the voyages, I started to learn to back off a little bit in terms of my blunt questioning, but I think especially in China, I noticed that.
What kind of questions? Like, how many books are in your library?
No, I mean, I was asking political questions in China. For example, I asked to meet with a leading person in the Communist Party in Shanghai. Uh-huh. And so they set up a meeting with this person. And I started asking him about what he thought the situation was, and as far as democracy and so on. And then I started giving my own views. And it, you know, in spite of the fact that, this was in 1989, and it was just before everything exploded, the guy would say, no, everything's fine, we don't have any problems. In fact, I said, well, from what I can see, that isn't the case. But he perceived it as rude, and I didn't really mind too much because I was talking to a bureaucrat. But sometimes, you know, when you're talking to an ordinary person, you do the same sort of thing. I felt I needed to learn to be a little bit more sensitive about things. Mm.
Thank you for that, Tom, and just the self-learning that you have in that space, recognizing he's perceiving this in a way that's different from how I'm intending it. That in itself can be the start of some self-reflection and learning. That's really helpful. But I think that's a common challenge. Folks in lots of different cultural contexts perceive our questions, our presence. We step in, and I'll own it as a white male, upper-income white male or upper-middle-income. I step into a space, and there's all kinds of unexamined white privilege. And so this person needs to answer to me. I'll ask a question, and I deserve to be given an answer. Well, you know, a lot of people said, really? You know, you don't quite understand what's going on in the room here. And so I'm just saying, with those different reads of the reality of what's going on in the room, it sets us up for a perfect storm that I was describing, based on the ethnocentricity, racism, privilege that are going to be the foundational stones of our military policy, of our mission policy, of our foreign aid, and our interaction with different cultures.
So it's a volatile mixture, and here we go. You know, we step into it, we make mission decisions with our dollars, we send people, we allocate human resources, we advocate for certain policies, believing that we know best. Have we talked to a Guatemalan indigenous person about this policy we're maintaining for them? So that's what the book is trying to build up, a space for those kinds of conversations. I'm sorry, can you say something?
Well, I was just going to say, where I work, there's some software that if you're going to deal with people from other cultures, you take this little survey, you answer all these questions, and you say, okay, here's where I plot, I'm sort of like those continuums, and here's somebody from India. This is a typical person from India, and you can see where you have far apart things and where you're close. So you can, like, put, you know, like this huge database of what, you know, people have answered, I guess. So you can see where in another culture or country or whatever, where you would find vast differences or something. So it's just interesting.
Sure, yeah. So they're doing what I'm trying to do, and having said that, you're describing the simplicity of an instrument. It presents a simplistic reality, and we all rush to say there's a lot more nuance and possible to encounter. And between two human beings, if you're, you know, in a committed relationship with a person who is very similar to you culturally, there are still differences. Thank you very much. And they
please bring it back. Please
go back across the table.
A question that maybe I don't want to get ahead of things, but maybe just plant it for later on.
Yeah.
Are other countries that have that scored differently on some of these indices and personality traits and et cetera that than Americans do? Do they do a better job? Those who can afford to give, who take an interest in other countries and do other. And do mission or for aid or whatever, do they do a better job than we do?
A great question. And because I worked, when we worked with a mission agency, we noted that whereas we would say we would value the number of years a Caucasian had worked cross-culturally, we found that there were many African-Americans, Latino, Latina, Hispanics, others who merely by living in this cultural context in the United States, they were living cross-culturally. So they got credit for, like, you know, the 28 years that they had been alive here. And so we realized that we had to evaluate differently. So I think that gave a lot of folks different from me a step up. They've been doing this all their lives. They had been so sensitive to power issues that I was completely ignorant of. I would step on people, and they would say, I've been stepped on all my life. I'm going to think before I move there. So in some ways, there's an opportunity both in this country and in lots of places. I work with a Palestinian missiologist who is so sharp in his analysis of power dynamics that it's so helpful. I just, you know, to get a read of a situation, he says, well, have you thought about this, and this? No, never. It never occurred to me because of the way I was raised. My studies have helped me a step, but nowhere near where you feel it in your bones. So there's a lot of strength to that. There's also an opposite reaction among some folks who, as they push away from the pain of having been stepped on, become worse of an oppressor than the that had been stepped on. And so that can also happen. And so I think those are human reactions that I'm not judging, because I do both of those, I'm sure, in different moments. But so I think I appreciate the comment, and let's look as we move ahead. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, Peter, even in asking the question, do other cultures do better than we do, that's such an American question.
Yeah, it really is.
Are we the best?
Right.
Absolutely
right. Why aren't we the best, and how can we be better?
Right.
So,
how can we win this one? Okay. Okay. We're going to look briefly at the five principles, and I'm just going to lift them up because I think they're helpful to us. Most of these images I've got either from David Young, who for many years was a photographer for the Presbyterian Church's Mission Agency, or from Newton and Early. I've been in correspondence with Newton and Early, the two authors of this book, because I found their book fascinating. I just reviewed it on Amazon or some book website, and then they got in touch with me and said, saw that, are you using it with some of your faith-based groups? Because I mentioned that. And so we started a little back and forth, and so they sent some images for us to use. In the chapter on respect and value people, so these are going to sound quite elementary and it should be just a given in human relationships, and part of us is aware of that. But I was talking with Tom. One thing a congregation that I've worked with did was they said, you know, these principles we so believe in, why don't we write them down? Now, why don't we ask ourselves, in this decision that we're making, to what extent are we respecting and valuing these people as collaborators, friends, partners, rather than as the objects of our mission? Just to give some thought, some time, some space to that, just to breathe and ask some deeper questions of how are we showing respect and valuing them, their analysis of the problem, when they start claiming the Frarian tree down of why. What is the cause? What's the root cause of this symptom of poverty that I'm seeing? How do we get to the... They will have a very different analysis of poverty and its causes than I will. And yet most of our mission dollars, if we're not sending it to the symptoms, orphanages, child care, child sponsorship, or packaging food, oftentimes, if we allow ourselves to go a little deeper, we realize that their analysis of the problem may be quite different. So what are ways that we can respect and value people in this cross-cultural relationship? In the book, you may remember there's a long-term volunteer by the name of Diane. There's a woman who travels for a short-term experience. Her name is Ellie, and she visits, and she keeps coming back time and time again with a good idea. Well, why don't you do it this way? Why don't you do it that way? And Diane, who's been around the block a few more times, though she still stumbles and falls at times, and I appreciate the honesty of the book, they set it up so that Ellie is constantly coming in and offering some ideas and also some funding. She's helpful in going out and identifying people who will help this project. And finally, there's Amalia, who is a Guatemalan women's leader, very dynamic in that space. She's a teacher and is really helpful to both Diane and Ellie to root these efforts that they're making in the local community. At a point in the book, Diane talks about this as a three-legged stool. She says, you know, we did it, and that's great. Their project works. They're able to do what they set out to do. And they realized that there was a kind of a collaboration that naturally flowed. The relationships got together in such a way that Ellie did what she could do best, Diane did what she could do best, the longer-term person who spoke the language, she spoke Spanish but not an indigenous language, and then Amalia, who was deeply rooted in context, knew who everybody in the village was, and could help root that project in the soil of that place. They described that as a three-legged stool, and I would offer to our mission committees, our churches, try to think of yourselves, what part of that three-legged stool are you playing? Because I think you may have folks in your congregation who regularly travel out to different places where their community here in Pittsburgh, maybe they spend time tutoring with a local community. Maybe they're working in a food bank. Maybe they're working in advocacy issues for undocumented workers in this city. Maybe they're doing that internationally. I don't know about the scope of your work exactly. But what we're finding is if they can see themselves as part of a larger whole, it's not just about their decision-making, writing a check or giving time, but rather how are they rooting themselves? Who are the local informants, the people who will be making decisions in their own community? And to what extent are we empowering them? So that's part of this principle of respecting and valuing the people that you're called to work with. Okay, let's go on to the next one. There's a great Chiluba proverb in the Congo. The Chiluba language is spoken by about 2 million Presbyterians. It's a church that's grown tremendously over the last 120 years. Oftentimes, despite us mission workers who work there, it's in fact when most of the mission workers came out, that's when the church grew the most. Not to say that I'm not all in favor of sending the right mission workers to do the right things.
in partnership with the local church. But it is a phenomenon that we see when the missionaries came out of China. That's really when the church grew, post 49 in the last 60 years, etc. So I won't belabor that. The proverb says, which is the foreigner, you walk into a village, every child in the village knows which is the best pollen tree to get the pollen wine from. Usually, it's only one variety. There's 74 different varieties of palm trees in the Congo. Only one of them produces the best pollen wine. If you're a wine connoisseur, you walk in, I can't do this, but you walk in a wine shop and you say, that's it. This is really good wine, right? You just know. It's a process of trial and error. Well, folks know in the Congo, but every kid knows where the people go to get pollen wine. They know that. As a foreigner, you walk in, you may have a PhD, you may be smart as tacks, you may have it all going for you, you may have a lot of money in your pocket, but you have no idea which is the right palm tree to get the palm wine from. So it's every time a foreigner gets going a little too quickly, somebody in the circle in the Congo will say, when ye got to money, you would get a butch. The foreigner really can't know which is the best palm tree. So in other words, we need to speak for the local knowledge, to value that local knowledge, the local wisdom, because we really have to make decisions for ourselves. And that's a very empowering proverb that was taught early to the mission workers as they came to say, it's a checkpoint, just saying, let's wait a second. That's part of that valuing and respecting of the people that you're called to work with. Okay. The second principle, if we could look to that, is this, to build trust through relationships. That's the second principle that Newton and Early offer. This is based on a short-term mission. What I like about Fran Newton and Connie Early's book is that they lift up in a story format. So they're telling five different stories and to sort of walk you through in a very implicit way. Note they're using an implicit form of storytelling, more like the gospel parables than Pauline, man after my own heart. Pauline definitely a white male. He just comes at you, he tells you exactly, here's the points, A, B, C, here's how it's lined up, linear logic, you know, also that Pauline. Well, in the story that they tell, Lucy, who is gone, she's a young person, and she's making not a long-term commitment, but she wants to spend a few years in service to this particular community. And she opts to begin to listen, to value, to respect the people that she's with, and to build relationships. And what I think is really powerful is, as those relationships deepened, she was enabled to understand their perspective a little more. When that happens, it leads her into solidarity with the people of that particular community. She discovers that's a painful thing. It puts her at odds with other North Americans. Other North Americans say, oh, you need to be able to do, you should do this, you should do that. You all should pick up the pace. This, you could help more people if you just did X, Y, or Z. And it puts Lucy in some tension with them because she says, that's not the way that things are done here. She's already begun to sink her roots into the particular community that she's been called to serve. It generates friction in her relationship. Okay, let's look at the third principle we could tell them. This is a principle that I think all of us are aware of in our relationships with friends, with colleagues at work, people we supervise, people we're supervised by, to do with rather than for. How could we turn our mentoring situations into two students, realizing that neither one of them has all the knowledge in the world, that they need each other to complete their knowledge? That kind of mutual mentoring would be a way of doing with rather than for. You all, if those of you who've read the book, will remember the story of Stanley, who brings a check for $10,000. And Stanley, he's got a lot of money. He doesn't have a lot of sense of what's going on in terms of human interaction or cross-cultural interaction in that space. But he's a learner. And what you got to appreciate Stanley in this story, because step by step, he backs up, he asks some questions, he's silent, he thinks, and he realizes that maybe popping $10,000 on the table to help folks in that particular context is not necessarily the best way to do things.
one of the challenges, what this group is doing, is it's a mission group that's come as an expression of their partnership with the local community, and they're trying to decide if this reforestation project is the best, or if the coffee cooperative is the best, or if the women's small micro-loan program is the best, and which should they support? Asking a very American question, which is best, and which would it be most of our mission dollars? How would we get the biggest bang from the buck, the most human change? I'm asking questions that we ask all the time of our mission projects, right? But Fran, early in particular in this chapter, is asking the question, are we monetizing our relationships? Are we commodifying the people that we say we're trying to help? Are we, in fact, not doing good when we say we're trying to do that? Stanley asked a great question that I think I've asked in my own heart a million times. This is the first time I've ever said it out loud, so I'll own this. Why is it so damn complicated to help somebody out? Yeah. Well, think of every human relationship you've ever been in, right? I think I spent the first 10 years of marriage thinking I should change my spouse. Huh. How'd that work for you, Hunter?
Well, 10?
Only 10, right. Yeah. Well, she's a... Yeah, anyway. So, but
she's
you realize... Well, yeah. She, you know, she finally helped me see a different way. But it was with a lot of pushback and more than a little friction, right? So not to get off on my marriage, but you do realize that this, even from similar cultural backgrounds, human beings, we are so complex. The differences between us are so nuanced that it takes a lot of time and patience and love and care in creating a space, a sacred space, where you can actually listen to each other. I appreciate someone like Stanley, who is, he's coming from this business background, he's looking to make a bang for the buck, he wants to see results quickly, there's a timeline on this, he's got a short-term orientation, and he's looking to make change. And so it's very frustrating, but you've got to appreciate him in this chapter, how he slowly but surely makes a turn towards, I wonder how people here would do it. And his last line in the chapter, he's asking questions that are much more empowering questions in his orientation. Okay, that's the third principle. The second last principle is ensure feedback and accountability. Let me do two takes on feedback. Sure glad the hole isn't at our end, right? Here's the mutual accountability that we're always looking for, right? Well, if it's not a problem on my end, I don't have to worry about it. That's their problem. That's one take. Let's flip to the next slide. Also, in that sense of accountability, there's a sense of, well, you know, why aren't you being accountable for what you should be doing? Well, what's it about specs and logs, right? In the Gospel of Matthew, we realize that we should do a little self-examination, self-evaluation, before we engage in that all-important evaluation of the other. Very few congregations, only 17% of PCUSA congregations, according to their mission leaders, only 17% of PCUSA congregations evaluate the work that they're doing around the world. Well, ain't no government study, university study, government work, business, private sector work, it goes very far if it doesn't evaluate its words. But we don't do that because, well, this is benevolence. This is our church. We're doing good. So why would you ask questions of how I'm doing good? I think that's why I've gotten the pushback I have in Presbyterian church circles when you ask some of these questions. When you begin to go deeper and unearth some of the racism and the ethnocentricity that's so present in our mission decision making and the way we treat people around the world saying that we want to do good. So I think that my sense is I kind of uncovered a space where people are very uncomfortable because I'm asking questions of evaluation of the work that we together do as Presbyterians, as a denomination. In this particular chapter, as they look at this, sometimes the results of pushing for greater results. And they use this analogy, this image of a sweater with a, you dropped a stitch when you were knitting a sweater. And if you don't go back and fix it, you're always going to have a problem. And soon that can pull out and the whole sweater can come undone. Well, to the credit of the community group that's working on this, they realized they were under pressure from overseas. Some of the North Americans were saying, this is a great project. You need to do more. And so that sense of,
If it's good for $100, it'll be twice as good for $200. Well, we'll give you $500. So how many more community workers can you hire? How many more projects can you do? How many more villages can we reach? That's kind of that frontier mentality. And people are smiling. I don't know you, so I'm not criticizing you. I'm criticizing myself as I say this. But almost all of our mission projects, you can see that sense of, if even just a little bit works well, we start funding that and say, make it bigger. We want to see it bigger. Well, the challenge of that is if we drop a stitch in human relationship, we've got to go back and fix that. We've got to find some reconciliation. Maybe we've stepped on some people along the way. We've got to go back to that if we're going to be able to move forward together. So I appreciate the honesty of this that particular chapter, because all of us struggle. We have a strong desire to hold others accountable, but not necessarily be held accountable ourselves. So a question I'll ask you all in a couple of weeks when we get together again, those of you who are able to make it, is the question of self-evaluation. To what extent are you evaluating your own congregation according to the agreements that you make with a partner? Maybe you say you're going to be helping them to advocate for an issue of justice. Maybe it's about our foreign aid system. Maybe it's about undocumented workers in this country. A host of different issues. What are ways that you're holding yourselves accountable to your partners, even as you're holding them accountable in the spending of mission dollars? So that's something we'll look at together. Let me look at the fifth principle with you, and then we'll open it up for some conversation. And that's the evaluate every step. Evaluating, there's a character in the fifth chapter by the name of Stephanie. And she, you can tell it's a shift, a significant transformation in Stephanie as this chapter develops. She moves into a space of what I've described as self-development. One of the concepts within the Presbyterian Church that the church has valued for a long time is that concept of self-development. Empowering a community to make decisions for itself. How would they choose to spend these dollars? And so it's, I remember Fred Wall, I traveled with Fred Walls, who was the director of the self-development program for years. We traveled together to Togo, and we went to community, we went to maybe 17 different communities in the west side of Togo in West Africa. And people would beg for an application form. He said, oh, there's no application form to self-development. You tell us what you want to do. Because if we start putting you in our boxes, in our criteria, in our valued judgments, you're going to conform to that, even subconsciously. We want to give you an open slate. Here's a clean piece of paper. Tell us, what's the dream? What are your concerns? What makes you laugh and cry at night? When you go to sleep, why do you cry for your children? What do you want to fix? What do you want to work on? That's what we want to help you to work on. And that's that notion of self-development, and that's a very powerful thing when you're able to engage someone in that. There's also a part of the chapter that looks at the differing values for evaluation. You may be aware that different communities will value certain things. You may look at results that are measurable, which is really important in our cultural context. We want to know, back when I was growing up, I remember a particular evangelist talked about, he went to our church and gave a presentation and said, I can't remember the number exactly, it was like, for $7, we can save a soul. And I mean, it generated incredible response in our congregation. You'd be like, oh my gosh, well, I have $7. I mean, an eternal soul, that's a big deal. So, people were just popping money into that plate, and because he had come up with the formula that you speak to a culture like ours of measurable results, and people... I'll challenge you, look at just about any mission organization today, as they present, as they make their pitch to you, they're going to talk about results. Whether it's, how many half llamas you can, get to the community, or pigeons, or cows, or whatever. But that measurable result... Pardon me?
Goats.
Goats, yeah. Don't you know? How many goats? But those measurable results are so important to us. It may be that Amalia's community, an indigenous community, values human relationship more. And so it's going to be more important to them that people and their relationships not be stepped on rather than the criteria of the measurable changes that you and I might see. So when you can do what we call mutual evaluation,
where you're doing an evaluation, what's been the impact on that community, and what's been the impact on us in being involved in this work? And that changes the dynamic significantly, and I think is the helpful one. Okay, those are the main ideas. If you're looking for the quick read, the sixth chapter is the conclusions, and they just lift up kind of the lessons of each chapter, and so that's a quick read. If you're looking for a deep read, read that first, then go back and read the book, and it helps you to sort of line up there the arguments that Fran and Connie put into this book that I think is really helpful. I wanted to get a sense from you all to what extent, and this is just going to kind of open us up for conversation for a couple of weeks from now, to what extent are some of these values present in the way that you engage in personal philanthropy or charity? How are some of these values expressed in some of the ways that you're engaged as a congregation in different mission projects, whether through Presbyterian Women or your mission or your justice committee? Do you see some of these principles maybe fleshed out in some of the decisions you're making or the process you use to make decisions? What do you see in that?
Well, I think one thing is that over the past couple of years, I think largely just through dialogue that we've had and with a lot of guidance from Vincent, is that we've really changed a lot of the focus of our mission giving toward more of a social justice and advocacy slant. I mean, we've made a significant reallocation of our funds. And I think probably a lot of that has been, a lot of the social justice advocacy we do is really focused on domestic issues. We've moved away, I mean, I don't think we really, personally, really have a clue what we could do to advocate for social justice in other countries. And so we've certainly got plenty of issues to chew on and work with here in the United States. And so that's, I think, is what we've tended to do as we've shifted those funds is probably much more of a domestic emphasis than we had previously.
Thanks. Other ways maybe you have lived into some of these principles that the authors sketch out? One of the things I'm wondering about, Peter, as you speak, when I talk with folks under 30 who come to show up at a Presbyterian gathering, whether it's a mission gathering or a youth rally or whatever, when you talk to them, one of the things that they get instantly is the connection of the local and the global. Human trafficking is such an important topic, I think, to the rising generation, because they see the lines that connect it. Now, Presbyterian Women, back in the late 1800s, got those connections also. They were ministering to poor women who've been abandoned and forced into prostitution in China, even as they were ministering in San Francisco, developing institutions to receive these women who were brought over as sex trafficking slaves. And so even back then, Presbyterian Women were making that connection of the local global. Folks under 30, that most of our mission board's history, we have not made that connection. We've divided bitterly the National Board of Missions, which looked at issues of justice, and the global mission, which has tended to be evangelism. Right. And so you get the Lausanne Covenant group, and you get the World Council of Churches group. And it's fascinating. We just bifurcated our church's understanding of mission when Jesus Christ was about the local and the global, was about the sharing faith as well as the justice every step of the way. So it's interesting. I do think folks under 30 get those natural connections, and a challenge I do with you as you look at a focus on a domestic mission is to think in terms of, are there some connecting points that would invite folks under 30 who kind of get this whole holistic approach? When we bifurcate it, it's more difficult. That's what we're experiencing for folks under 30. They're like, so why are you just doing that? We have to look at the broader scheme of things. So that may be a piece that
is their own church.
Right. Yeah, it's getting
better. Here, many of them are, including my kids.
Sure, yeah.
They're from their
church.
Right?
Yeah.
And what we're finding is these concerns of justice is what's drawing some folks back into the church, not others.
it is that concern that they're, and particularly now, I'll say this, having come to Pittsburgh, Ruth and I moved up in, we just got here in January, in fact, there's never been a better time to organize. I mean, in the last 20 years, people are coming out of the woodwork. Mm-hmm. People who show no solidarity with undocumented workers in this country are out, willing to go out on the streets.
Yeah.
They're willing to protest. So there's something moving, and there's a lot of folks under 30 who are saying, who's in?
Well, the irony is you can make a good business case for that, too.
There sure is. Mm-hmm. There sure is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Huge.
Yeah.
Because we're communal, but we're also a commercial country. Mm-hmm. And commerce creates jobs.
Right. Yeah, and we're seeing a lot of business becoming the strongest supporters of whether it's DACA or, yeah, I mean, we're fascinating, and legislators who won't listen to it for a variety of reasons.
The picture that I found that really resonated with me was the self-accountability, because we had a completely different conversation than I would have anticipated I would have had before. In our Justice Committee just a week ago, with an endeavor that's in some transition, and the way we reframed our conversation about that was what we've kind of been exploring around white privilege and sacred conversations about race and action, how privilege, previously unexamined privilege, would have allowed us to walk away from something and not feel any remorse or repercussion. And what I watched in the conversation, Peter was there, Pam was there, is we felt like privilege did not give us, being aware of white privilege did not give us the out that we could walk away from this. We needed to step up more. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever would have thought about what was the decision if we hadn't done some really conscientious conversations around what privilege is. Mm-hmm. And the conversations around privilege are really making me rethink a lot of things, really taking self-stock about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. For example, when someone says, that's political, you know, so I don't like that, that's political. I hear the word privilege now instead of political, which is, and that's it. I'm just trying to work through the filters on
that. I can isolate that away from the rest of human existence.
Yeah, because I'm in a place where I have the luxury to be able to do that.
Yeah, right.
So that's different. I wouldn't have thought that way 2 years ago.
Good point, Vince.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'm actually understanding.
Well, when somebody says, I don't want to get engaged in something because that's political, what that basically, what I'm hearing it now, and maybe this is slanted, is you're touching on my privilege in a way and wanting me to examine something that I don't have to because of my position in society, and I don't like that, and I want to declare that out of bounds. It's a power thing. That's what I try to imagine.
Right. As we would say, for example, and I'll throw myself to the wolves on this one, if Israel Palestine would say, no, we need an even-handed approach. And so the Palestinians would say, oh, really? Well, let me, if you see this from my perspective, this may change the conversation. And so I think we can quickly say, well, we need equal time, we need assumption of the, we talked about the flat earth, the low power distance assumptions of this culture, but that leads us to a space of remarkable privilege. Desmond Tutu, was it, who said the precious, you know, the elephant stepping on the mouse, and the mouse doesn't appreciate the efforts to be neutral. You know, please understand my reality. I think that there's some power in that we have to assess. Other ways that you see in your own, either your own efforts to be charitable, to do good, and this is inviting you into a space of deep reflection, excuse me, for I don't know you well, and so and I just want to toss that out. As I engage, let me just for myself, as I engage, I realize that the privilege, I allow myself distance. I don't want to get my hands dirty. I mean, I try to keep myself separate from that person. I don't want to make it as if I won't pull my wallet out in that space. I don't want to be drawn into the human element. And so I distance myself. I'd rather write a check and send it than engage in a face-to-face, hand-to-hand, eye-to-eye contact. I'm telling the story myself that there's an awkwardness, there's vulnerability. That person may surprise me, they may say something, they may ask for more. And so it's a little safer if I can send my money to the church mission committee and take care of that. Then do I say on the street, oh, I gave it to church. I don't have to worry about this encounter that's coming towards me. That I find myself distancing, and that comes to me, I think, from a space of privilege, particularly economic privilege, but also racial privilege, that allows me to say, you know, I don't have to worry about you as a human being and your needs, because I gave it to church.
That touches us every day in Squirrel Bill.
Boy,
you confront homeless folks on the street, and we're quite bold about coming and asking, or sitting outside the theater and make you feel guilty for having spent $12 on a movie. Mm-hmm. They don't have supper. That's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
There's this empty place between people, especially on different sides of a political divide. Mm-hmm. For instance, Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. That space, I mean, that the police were 100% focused on enforcing that space physically. Mm-hmm. But the thing, progress happens when people from both sides find a way to step into that space and connect. Mm-hmm. And that's it's not just money that prevents that, but instead it's political views as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this has to do with the mission, but it connects with what you just said.
We're touching close to the mission of God here, so I think we're almost there. Yeah.
I find myself trying to be, rational, like how much global, local, how much percent environmental, this, that, did I cover all the bases? Have I given a little bit to a lot of people so that I've covered? Yeah, I kind of covered everything, So then it's like, so you feel comprehensive because you did pot shots here. So you said, I'm well-rounded or whatever you did. So
above reproach.
Yeah. So, that is interesting to kind of think, well, if you're looking at root causes and things like that, then just pot-shotting around is probably not the most useful way to make differences.
And I'm interested in thinking with you about that maybe in our next conversation in particular, because there's, if we play the continuum game again, to tease out difference, there's one approach that's a congregation gives everything to one, engages in one deep relationship. There's another that is both changing and multiple partners. Sounds like the wrong. Sorry. But numerous groups, partnerships. Looking for ways, if we tease those out, are there ways that maybe some of these principles could take root in our approach? Would it lead us one way or the other on that continuum? So that's a question I'd like to think with you about as you think about strategies, how you want to engage together. And it's complex enough when it's one individual, if you're making a decision for yourself, more complex for, say, a family and for a community like this. It's,
when my kids were smaller, it's like, okay, what is the thing that you're really into? Okay, African animals, we're going to get some money to African animals. Sure. And what is it you're into? Okay, this. Okay, we're going to get some money to that. Because, you just try to, get them interested in whatever, the family's doing. But, again, that's not necessarily looking at anything strategically or any other kind of evaluation type thing of saying, is that really the best place that I could be?
And I want to thank you. You're inculcating generosity. You're inviting your children to experience generosity and value that. And that's a beautiful thing. And the flip side, because I do this, I've done this with my kids, it also speaks to my quite privilege in a sense that I'm putting myself in the power seat, allocating funds to individuals based on my criteria, my evaluation of their need, their capacity to receive the funds, using, etc. And so that's one model. Are there other ways? And that's what I guess I'm with that continuum. Are there other models out there? What would it look like? And I guess the homeless person is just so raw to all of us because we experience that, if not daily, often. But is it, you know, what happens if we're called into a relationship with someone, someone's, a community, a group that's working on a particular issue? Are there ways that we could go deep together and develop that kind of relationship where they're calling us out, even as we might call them out, say, well, you didn't spend the money like you said you should, you said you would, etc. I just want to open up the question, and maybe we can be thinking about it in the next couple of weeks, but it brings us to some harder questions, and again, I don't want to criticize you or anyone, all of us who've done that, but there is almost a shadow side of that, where we abrogate the power of that we, by materializing or by monetizing the relationship that mission is meant to be. Maybe we should think a little bit, maybe I should pass from the civil society's definition of benevolence and charity and all this, and land the plane more in this people of faith. Mm-hmm. So what are we called to do as Christians? So that may be a good time to do that. Yeah, thanks. Please. Yeah, I'm sorry, you had asked for something in
right, so so I'm progressive, and I hate global mission.
There you go.
Vince,
that's good. Don't worry.
What did you say? What confession did you make that I didn't?
She's progressive.
And I hate global mission.
I called the card on you earlier on.
So I guess there's a part of me that part of the reason I hate global mission is that I feel that I personally don't have the capacity to evaluate it. Mm-hmm. Right? So someone comes up to me and says, there's starving children in Africa, please feed them, and I don't have the capacity to evaluate the veracity of their claim, nor the effectiveness of their outreach. Mm-hmm. So I feel really generally conflicted about this conversation, because I guess as an individual, I prefer to support organizations that I can see, feel, and touch, mm-hmm. Local organizations, and often disaster relief is sort of an exception to this. I'll put that in its own little bucket. But other than that, I feel like it's really uncomfortable for me to want to do global mission well, because I don't know that we can.
So thank you for your brutal honesty. Seriously. And I mean, and you're showing a lot of integrity, saying, because I can't know that, there's no way for me to assess it. And so I would be wrong to throw money here or there or the other, because I can't say A, B, or C, which is best. I appreciate that. Let me also, just in that same vein, is there a shadow side of that where we place ourselves in a place of, I need not, and this is not about you, this is about me, when I choose not to engage, none of us can engage in everything. Everything's pulling at us from 1,000 different places in the world, not only, plus here at home. So, but is there a space where we're called, and maybe we're called together, maybe it's not each of us has to assess the 40 causes or 20 things or 2 things that we're going to do internationally and then locally. Is there a chance that we're called together to do one thing? Could we develop a depth of relationship that allows us to know more about each other? That we insist on the
Maybe these five principles or others that you should determine yourself. I don't take anybody's principles. These are helpful. If they are helpful, take them. If not, you know, determine. But could we have that same integrity that you're showing in terms of living these principles of valuing, respecting, valuing other people, listening to them, establishing relationships of mutuality? These different values, are there ways that we can establish that with a group of people? If not, I'm wondering, boy, we got off easy on that one. We just drew a small circle around what we can see and touch and say, I'm just feeling some sense of responsibility for this. And so that's where I get wake up in the night and think that I think my circle has to be bigger. But because I'm way over here on individualistic versus collectivistic, I'm way over here. So no one beats me in that. I'm really individualistic. And given that, why is it all about me? Why do I have to draw that circle? Could we be called together to find a way to enlarge all of our circles and make it one circle? So I'm tossing out just different ideas, but I think this will help us maybe be grist for the mill when we think about this.
So my question is also related to assessment and evaluation. And I'm new to this community, so I don't know any of you well, but please, you also answer me if you can. So I was doing voluntary service for the past year in Zambia. So I was sent by a religious nonprofit, a Mennonite nonprofit. And I spent the year living with a host family and working with a Zambian development organization. And I was to do the monitoring and evaluations for this Zambian development organization. So there's these two different organizations that I'm engaging with. This one organization that calls itself a global organization but is really a North American-run organization, and then this Zambian organization that I interact with on a daily basis. So through this experience, I've seen that assessment and evaluation are very important, right? That I saw a bunch of other organizations walk into a country and do a thing and leave, and then never go back to assess what happens, right? You go and you dig some wells, and then you leave, and 6 months later the wells are broken and nobody can use them, but the person who built them doesn't check on them, right? Like, so there are all of these examples where not having assessment is really sort of just destroying the function of everything you try to do.
It's a waste of time.
Right, yeah. And then trying to do the monitoring and evaluations for this Zambian development organization, it became very clear that it was all very donor-driven, right? The evaluation was for the people who were giving money. They wanted to see specific answers, so we have to make those things happen, right? And so this is what you were talking about with the measured results, right? And how measured results are not. We shouldn't be so focused on these measured results. But then there's this other thing of, but assessment actually is important. Like, you have to do something. So what I want to hear, anyway, that was a long answer to my question.
It's
okay.
Great, though.
Great. It's great.
But so my question is, do you have specific examples of ways that evaluation, do you have models of evaluation that does work for this sort of, like, benevolent work?
The only people who monitor or evaluate a project are the ones who own the project and depend on its success. So I think one of the challenges is, oftentimes, you know, I would ask the question, whose project was that?
Mm-hmm.
That the Zambians, you know, if you're saying, you yourself saying it's a donor-driven project,
you
look at this reality. And so I think so many of these projects, I mean, Paul Jeffrey has been a Methodist missionary for many years in Central America and Mexico. And he did this article kind of saying, after the short-term mission group leaves, and then he would go to the community that he knew and he had relationships with, so he would interview people. What was that? That thing that just happened for the last 2 weeks, what was that? And, you know, the North American's description, this is what we're going to do, and the people's description, this is what it was, were night and day difference. And so I ask, oftentimes when people speak of le projet,
the proyecto, the project, they're talking about different animals, totally. And so when, you know, all the language, and I've worked with Congolese who sort of jump into this assessment and monitoring language outfit, and they sort of put it on mentally, and they speak that language, but it's not their language. The beautiful thing is chapter 5 in the book, it shows a process of evaluation that begins to, it springs up out of the hearts of the women who are involved, because they want to make sure that their kids get the best care possible. And so it's a beautiful twist, because it starts out, it's the external, it's the donor driven, and it's, you all got to do that with us, count this, you know, count the measurable results are very important to them. And just in the nuance, the interplay of relationship, you realize a change, and suddenly the women are stepping up and saying, this is what they want to evaluate, this is what they want to monitor. So I think that only springs up. I mean, my tendency when I go into these places oftentimes has been, through my time, has been the question of, can I be patient enough to allow the project to develop from within, rather than me come in, you know, I'll say it crassly, a guy came from church, a big church in Texas, came to Congo. I was a volunteer at that time. I was 23 years old. He comes and he takes a check for $1,000. It must have been money, because we lose checks in Congo. So it was a packet of money or something. Put it on the table. I can't remember exactly. But so there's every pastor in the presbytery is sitting in this circle. And suddenly, this group that had deep relationships, they'd gone to the bat for each other. The golden apple of discord was thrown in their midst. And they were at each other's throats. They were dissing each other. And yeah, but then let me talk to you afterwards. And the Nicodemus visit, the people going at night and knocking on the donor's door. You know, if you knew what I know about this guy. The community shattered. And so my sense is when that sacred space is created where local initiative can meet some inputs they can't get from that place, oftentimes due to the economic macro conditions that are imposed from without, the copper belt, we can go into all kinds of extractive industry conversations about Zambia. With that reality, there are certain things that can't be done locally. Are there ways that a church like this could come alongside a partner in Zambia in ways that could open up space of evaluation, monitoring, valuing of their work that springs up from within? I guess that's the question I ask. The book paints a picture of how that can develop in a community. And if you're up for it, we can talk about it in a couple weeks when I come back. We can think together about some models that we've seen in some different communities, mostly through the work of either self-development of people or the First Free Hunger Program. And I'd love to hear the next story, because I have a lot of respect for many other works that they might send. Thanks for that. Other folks may have other comments or questions on that or this is basically what I wanted to think about with you tonight. I'm really appreciative of you for opening up this golden calf in Presbyterianism. I mean, this is a big issue, but very few people are talking about it. And with the publication of several of these books, I mentioned Toxic Charity, I mentioned The Helping Hurts, this book. There's also a book by Brian Howell that he's trying to map the short-term mission phenomenon. Because right up there with orphanages and child sponsorship and food packaging for communities most perceived to be poor is this whole area of short-term mission trips, which are, like I mentioned, $5 million in the industry in the United States.
It's a good place.
So that's what I wanted to share with you. If there are any other questions, comments, ideas, otherwise, we'll be back together in, I think it's a couple of weeks,
talking
about some more specific applications of these 5 principles to the work that you all do together or hope to do together.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it.
As a way of ourselves accountable. Let's make the commitment to be back here and bring somebody with us. Next time. All right.